This is live coverage on C-SPAN Radio.
I do want to say two words about the fact that we get together women to learn Torah. One of the things that I got from one of my teachers in Matan was that when we women want to learn Torah, the goal is not to be a Talmid Chacham. The goal is to be Talmidot Chachamim, meaning that to know who to turn to, who are the teachers of the generation to turn to and to learn Torah from them. And then we can lift ourselves up in Torah and move on. And Baruch Hashem, we're starting this Beit Midrash that will continue for the rest of the year. With one of the great Chachamim in this area to learn Torah from, and Bezrat Hashem will be able to lehagdil Torah veleadil, the rest of the year and years to come.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I also do want to say how thrilled I am to see such a wonderful turnout, and I think it's a tremendous accomplishment to be able to get the women together. Wouldn't be so bad for the men to get together either on a monthly basis. And perhaps you'll also be a source of inspiration to your husbands and children to continue this type of learning as well. Also very much appreciate that this session. I very much appreciate that this session was dedicated for a refuah shleima for Debbie Lerner. Today we in fact added an extra name to her name, so those of you who are saying Tehillim, her name is now Bracha. That's the extra Bracha, Devorah Mindel Bas Basya, and in the merit of all of your learning, she should have a refuah shleima. I would like to request after the session, if we or you could say just one chapter of Tehillim, I'll announce a Tehillim that you might say. It would just take around 2 or 3 minutes, and again, that should be a schus for her. I do apologize if some of the material that you read may have sounded a little insulting. I know it's kind of being kicked in the teeth. You make the effort to come out to a Beis Medrash, and then you read something that seems to say negative things. And obviously, you do have to get a sense, which you will get with the passage of time if you don't have it yet, as to which types of things are considered to be authoritative in Judaism and which are just one man's view. For example, the excerpt of the Torah Tamima, who was an eminent person who lived in the 20th century, about women's psychology is really nothing more than his view and his speculation, and it does not count, I would say, as a real Torah source, as opposed to something that the Rambam or the Gemara says we have to deal with, we cannot escape. So you do have to have a sense that not everything that is quoted in the name of every rabbi is equivalent. In fact, some people, for example, have criticized even a great posek like Rav Avadya Yosef. Often, when he is asked a question, he has a photographic memory, an absolutely amazing memory, he will simply tell you, 100 books say this, 51 say the following, 49 say the other way, therefore the halacha is in accordance with the 51. The problem is, the criticism people have is, there is no qualitative weighing. I mean, he'll weigh, 51 books of mediocre as compared to 40. No, so obviously it's a much more subtle process. So what you gain with experience, and again, this is something that, you will gain and can gain as well, is a sense of weighing and according various importance to authority. So that's really one thing. In retrospect, I shouldn't have included the Torah Tamima because, again, as I say, I'm not entirely clear that his point is valid in any sense at all. But to begin with some basics, and again, you've gone over this, but just to be sure everyone's at the same page, all of us know, anyone that is an observant Jew knows, that there are many mitzvot that women are exempt from. An exemption does not mean they're not allowed to do them. An exemption means they don't have to do them. Now, the general rule is that if it's a mitzvah saseh, if it is a positive commandment, which is time-bound, something that's limited in time, women are generally exempt. Now, even that so-called rule probably has more exceptions. If you added up all of the exceptions to that rule and all of things that are covered by the rule, there are probably more things that are not covered than are covered, meaning you have this rule which has many, many exceptions. But let's first talk about the ones that are covered by the rule. A woman, surprisingly enough, many people do not know this, is technically exempt from hearing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Although universally people want to come, because it's a mitzvah saseh that is time bound. A woman is technically exempt from sitting in the sukkah on Sukkos, because it is time bound. A woman is technically exempt from taking a lulav and esrog, because it's time bound, it is limited to sukkah. A woman is exempt from counting the omer, because it is a time bound commandment that only applies for 49 days. A woman is exempt from wearing tefillin, precisely because tefillin is not worn on Shabbos or Yom Tov. Tefillin is not worn at night. It is time bound. Same thing with tzitzis. A woman is exempt from tzitzis simply because tzitzis are not worn at night and it's time bound. So we have this rule called mitzvah saseh shazman gerama, a time bound positive commandment. On the other hand, to list the exceptions are very, very numerous. A woman must either hear or recite Kiddush on Shabbos, even though it's time-bound, because the positive mitzvah of remembering Shabbos is correlated to the negative prohibition against doing work. Whoever has the negative has the positive. A woman must eat matzah and drink the four cups of wine during the Seder. A woman must hear or recite the Haggadah. A woman must hear the Megillah. A woman must light, or even read the Megillah. A woman must light, or have someone light for her, the Hanukkah candle. So the point is, the rule of Zman Gerama is a rule, but it is subject to many, many exceptions. Each exception has its reason, to be sure, but if you actually make enumeration of how many are covered by the rule and how many are covered by the exception, there may be more that are covered by the exception than the rule. Now, when we come to the mitzvah of learning Torah, however, the rubric of Zman Gerama doesn't cover that, because Torah, above all, is not a time-bound commandment. Torah is supposed to be studied day and night. What did Hashem tell Yehoshua? V'hagisa bo yomam v'layla. You think about Torah day and night. The Gemara recounts that a certain person asked his uncle, Rabbi Yishmael, I already know so much Torah, when can I spend my time learning Greek wisdom? And Rabbi Yishmael told him, if you can find a time that is not night nor day, you can spend that time. That's a whole other talk about secular studies and where that has a room, but you know, it's not so simple. Many of you may have children who indeed are taking the position of Rabbi Yishmael, that they will only do secular education at a point that is neither day nor night. So, Limud HaTorah, okay, that's really another topic, but probably an important one. Limud HaTorah, therefore, is not a time-bound commandment. And yet, women are exempt from it. Why are women exempt? So you see the very first source. The Gemara in Kiddushin makes a drasha. Right? A drasha is simply rabbinic exegesis, rabbinic interpretation of Scripture. Limadetem osam espenechem. You shall teach your sons. And the word b'neichem is lashon zachar, is masculine. And without giving any reasons, there is no reason that is given at all. It simply says, the sons, not the daughters. Now, here you have to understand, again, to make an obvious point, just because there is an exemption from a mitzvah does not at all carry any implication that one should not do so voluntarily. Let's take, for example, the Zman Gerama exemptions. A woman is exempt from shofar, and yet universally, they try to hear it. And a woman is exempt from lulav, little less universally, but many, many women try to take lulav and esra. A woman is exempt from sukkah. Many women want to sit in the sukkah, and it's proper. Not only are they allowed to do it, but indeed, there's a famous machlokas among Ashkenazim and Sephardim, but it's an important machlokas to be aware of, and that is, if a woman voluntarily undertakes a mitzvah that she does not have to do, can she make a blessing over that mitzvah? Can a woman take a lulav and say, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav, God has commanded us to take a lulav? A woman is not commanded. There's a famous machlokas, Rabbeinu Tam, that was Rashi's grandson, and the Rambam, whether women have permission, because otherwise you're taking God's name in vain, can they make a bracha when there is an exemption? The Svardik rule, which is the Rambam's opinion, is a woman cannot make such a bracha. How could she say, God commanded us? God didn't command her. But Rabbeinu Tam, and this is the Ashkenazic practice as codified in the Ramah, basically says, that women can make the bracha as well. Because when you say, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav, you're not suggesting God gave me in particular, but God gave the Jewish people as a whole. And therefore, according to Rabbeinu Tam, not only are women encouraged in mitzvot aseh shazman gerama, but women are supposed to make a bracha, and they do get reward for doing these mitzvahs. The big question that you might ask, which I'll leave for another occasion, if I'm invited back, I don't know, is what about tefillin? Because l'chora, it's an interesting problem, because tefillin, the exemption of tefillin is exactly the same exemption as the exemption of sukkah and lulav and shofar. And yet for sukkah, lulav, and shofar, our approach is a woman does not have to do it, but is permitted to do it, encouraged to do it, and even makes a bracha on it. Why shouldn't that exact logic apply to the optional wearing of tefillin? It's a good question, I'll talk about it some other time. But the issue is this. We come to Talmud Torah, therefore, standing alone, we'll see there are other things, standing alone, the exemption of women from Talmud Torah says nothing about its desirability and says nothing about its appropriateness, right? It's only an exemption. Moreover, the Mefarshim say that the exemption is only from Talmud Torah as an end and not Talmud Torah as a means. And this is a fundamental distinction that has to be grasped. There are two dimensions in learning Torah. One dimension is, I need to learn Torah to know how to live as a Jew. I need to learn Torah to know how to live as a Jew in multiple levels. I need to have practical information, Shabbos, Kashrus, etc. I need to have to know what to believe and what to think and how to approach the world. I need the theological information, the emotional warmth. I need all that Torah has to give me. But that is Torah as a means to an end. There is, however, another dimension in Talmud Torah, that Talmud Torah itself is a form of divine worship and connection with God. That's why, for example, even if you learn Torah that has nothing to do with anything in your life, it's totally impractical, that itself is considered to be intrinsically kadosh. So here's what the commentaries say. Men and women have a different role here. In terms of the exemption, men are chayav in Talmud Torah as an end in itself. Women are chayavos in Talmud Torah, indeed, but not as an end in itself, but as a means to their actualization in knowing how to live a Jewish life. This would mean, therefore, of course, there's going to be a big question what this includes and what this excludes. Meaning, when it comes to matters of halacha, when it comes to matters of hashkafa, when it comes to matters of how to apply Torah to everyday life, men and women stand on an identical footing. Because all need Torah as a means to an end. But when it comes to learning that which is totally theoretical, which has no application to everyday life, at that point we would say, according to the classical exemption, that men and women diverge, at least in terms of their obligation. Again, we haven't yet discussed usher or not, but at least in terms of the obligation. And that is why the blessings that are recited over the Torah, the halacha, the Shulchan Aruch rules that women must recite those blessings every day, because even though they are not chayavos in Talmud Torah, they are chayavos lilmod es hamitzvos sheshayachin lahem. They are obligated to learn the commandments that apply to them. Now, you can already see that that type of rule is susceptible to an enormous amount of interpretation. Meaning, you gotta learn what is relevant in how you live a Jewish life. That's the standard. What does that mean, though? So on one hand, you have the Satmar Rebbe, who takes the position that all a woman has to know to meet that standard is a mechanical list of do's and don'ts, without any reasons, without any explanations, without any understanding. Others could take that same teaching and say, in order for a woman to live a Jewish life, I have to understand what I'm doing, and that requires that I go into everything. So the point is, the identical standard, the Satmar Rebbe and the most left-wing, full-fledged yeshiva for women, Kollel program, basically have the identical standard. That is, women need to learn what will help them live a more Jewish life. Exactly the standard. But how you define and apply that standard, there are going to be vast, vast differences. Whether you limit that to practical, everyday, mechanical knowledge, or whether there's an understanding that there has to be some intellectual and psychological sophistication and depth in order for that message to penetrate. But be it as it may, when you walk away, in fact, it just reminds me of a story that the late Revitin Soloveitchik, Yosef Soloveitchik's wife, once she recounted a conversation she had with a Satmar girl in the Satmar school system in Williamsburg. And I guess Revitin Soloveitchik didn't know about the different Hasidic schools, so she just raised to the girl, so you must go to a Beis Yaakov. So she says the girl started stuttering and shaking and quaking. He says, Beis Yaakov, dort mer lernt chumash. She said, they learn chumash in Beis Yaakov. You know, that's not possible. Okay. but, you know, it was like a horrifying thought. You know, they learn chumash. But okay. But anyway, but you walk away from the Gemara in Kedushin, all you see there is an exemption. You don't see any type of prohibition. Okay, it's very important to understand that. And if all you had was that text, we would say, okay, it's like lulav, it's like shofar. They want to do it, go ahead and do it. That's, they don't have to do it. And indeed, one might even say that the exemption from Talmud Torah is an exemption that is analogous to the exemption of Zman Gerama based on one of the most conventional interpretations, right? The conventional interpretation of Zman Gerama is that women cannot be compelled to do mitzvot at set times, because there are household responsibilities and the like, and God did not want to make a system that says you must break away from taking care of your child to do so and so. Well, one could say Talmud Torah, at least analytically, is a similar type of idea, because, you know, when you're engrossed in the middle of a difficult sugya, Tosfos and Rishonim and the like, and someone needs you, it's very, very hard to break away, and as a result, part of the engrossing nature of Talmud Torah might also give rise to at least the exemption. But the major problem that halacha has had in this area is not the Gemara in Kedushin, which is only an exemption, but it's a Mishnah in Sota. Right, that's the nexus. The Mishnah in Sota, of course, deals with a woman suspected of adultery. That is where we start getting the problem of prohibition. And that the history of this Mishnah and its interpretation is still a point of major contention in different groups in Orthodox, and again, I'm only talking about Orthodox halachic Jewry. The Mishnah in Sota, what does the Torah say? The Torah says if a woman had committed adultery, but we don't know, so she goes through an ordeal where she drinks water in which a parchment describing the punishments of the adulterous woman is written on parchment. It is dissolved in the water, and she drinks this. This is called the accursed water, the bitter Mayim Hamarim Hamaarim, the bitter accursed water. And through a miracle, the Torah says, if she is guilty, she immediately dies. And if she is innocent of suspicion, not only will she not die, but she will be blessed with fertility and the like. By the way, according to Chazal, the fellow that she committed adultery with, wherever he is, dies simultaneously with her. So he's wiped out. At the same time, the Gemara also says that this ritual of Sota stopped working sometime during the Second Temple period when the husbands were also unfaithful to their wives, meaning when you have this breakdown of morality where the husbands are committing adultery freely, then it doesn't do anything to the wives. But be it as it may, this is Sota. Now, the Mishnah is dealing with the following question. The Mishnah says, although the way it's supposed to work is the woman immediately dies, but it says if she has a certain zechus, if she has certain merits, she does not die right away, but she lingers on for 2 or 3 years. That's considered to be a merit. And the merit could be mitzvah or the like. Now, in connection with this, Ben Azai says the following statement. Ben Azai says, Chayav Adam, a person is obligated, not permitted, obligated, to teach his daughter Torah. Ben Azai says, obligated. Why is this? So the way Rashi explains, because if his daughter does not know these types of laws, when she sees people that she knows who committed adultery not dying right away, she will cast aspersions on the water. So she has to understand the halacha such as, you know, zechus can keep a person alive, so she will not cast aspersions on the mitzvahs. So Benazai actually infers from here an obligation to give our daughters sophistication in Torah knowledge. Now Benazai himself has a little interesting biography. Benazai actually, according to Chazal, did not get married. Benazai said he could not get married because his soul had such a desire to learn Torah that he didn't want to be tied down. Actually, Tosfos says Benazai actually was married. He was married to Rabbi Akiva's daughter, and they got divorced. One can imagine that perhaps he married Rabbi Akiva's daughter because he thought Rabbi Akiva's daughter would be like her mother, Rabbi Akiva's wife, who was willing to let her husband go away for 24 years with no distractions, and presumably she wasn't exactly the same way. And one could, again, I don't want to psychoanalyze it too much, but one could imagine a similar type of predicament, because Benazai didn't want to get married, because Nafsho Chashka B'Torah. But it's interesting that notwithstanding the fact that Benazai himself did not want to be involved, perhaps domestically for his own Torah learning, he was a strong advocate of women learning Torah, so they will understand what is going on. Now, we then have a second statement of Rabbi Eliezer. And this is also a very, very famous rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanes. And Rabbi Eliezer says, "Kol hamalamed es bito Torah." Anyone who teaches his daughter Torah, ki ilu malamda tiflus, it is as if he is teaching her tiflut. I leave that untranslated because a key issue in the debate is what is the translation of the word tiflut. There are two translations of tiflut. One translation of tiflut, tafel, is that which is tasteless, without meaning, futile or foolish, that without tam. Now, I'll go back and say, why would that be so? The second translation of tiflus is that which is immoral and leading to lewd behavior. So, tiflus is either foolishness, tasteless, doesn't do anything, or tiflus is actually a stronger term, conducive to immorality. Now, let's try to analyze, just in terms of how the commentaries understand each of those possible meanings. First of all, if you look at Rabbi Eliezer's statement, and this is an example of how important it is to look at language very closely, he does not say the word asur. He does not say it is forbidden. He states a consequence. Just like I might say, it's foolish to let your 16-year-old drive. I'm not telling you, don't, I guess in Maryland it's 18. Your 18-year-old drive. Yeah, even more foolish that your 16-year-old drive. It's not forbidden, but it may not be advisable. So one important question is Rabbi Eliezer saying something is asur? Or is he saying for whatever reason it's not advisable? That's one thing. But what is the tiflus issue? So let's take the two interpretations. Let's first look at the idea that tiflus means tasteless or without meaning. In other words, without taste. Unsalted food is called tafel. So here, once again, and obviously you could find all sorts of interpretations because this is kind of an open book. I do want to say one thing. The Torah Tamima, who was written in the early 20th century, quotes a statement that Chazal say in other contexts to the effect that Nashim Datan Kalos. Again, I'll explain it, so please don't take offense until I... And that is, women are lightheaded, and he matches that up to explain Ki'ilu Mulam de Tiflis. I want people to be very, very clear. Chazal do have a Maimer Chazal called Nashim Datan Kalos, and I'll try to explain what that is. It is not employed in Chazal as the explanation of Talmud Torah. That is a connection that some... Know, that he makes, but that, in other words, Chazal never say ki'ilu melamda tiflus is because of datan kalos. We often jump to that conclusion in terms of remembering misogynistic statements in rabbinic literature, so to speak, but it is not so. And in fact, the context in which datan kalos occurs is not always even a negative context. Datan kalos, some have said, could actually be a positive way. And that is to say, women are juggling many things at the same time, and therefore they might be unable to focus. For example, I'm not saying all women have ADD, but I just heard a psychiatrist say tonight, somebody was calling and complaining that they have adult, they think they developed attention deficit disorder as an adult. And apparently there's some dispute whether it can be developed as an adult. And the person made the following observation. This was a psychiatrist on the radio. He said, he was against the concept of overdiagnosis of these things, but he made the point that the ADD symptomology is actually an acute responsiveness to environmental changes. That if the smallest thing changes, you notice it right away. Dr. Carlos, it is said, the mind is swift. You go from one thing to another. You notice many, many things going on. And again, these are generalizations. We're not suggesting everybody's this way, but there is a concept that men tend to be more focused, right? Try to take your husband away from football. You know, he will roar, right? Or whatever it is, whether it's reading the paper, whether it's learning, whatever it is. Some have even suggested that's why some professional chefs are men, because they can stir soup for 5 hours. while mothers or whatever are doing other things at the same time. So Dr. Carlos is not necessarily a negative expression. It is simply a different modality of dealing with reality. And in either event, generalizations are not meant to say it applies to everybody. So the Dr. Carlos, I would actually factor out of the equation here, simply because it is not really referring to the exemption of Talmud Torah. It's really another idea. However, some say, very simply, that we go back to the notion of Zman Grama, the preoccupation with home and family. Do not, again, at least in the time of Chazal, I'll discuss whether today is different, but classically, did not give women the time, the leisure, or the presence of minds to commit themselves fully to the subtleties of Torah study, and therefore there was a fear that the study would be superficial, and there was a fear that superficial study could lead to the mockery of the Torah and may do more harm than good. That's one sociological explanation. Lack of time, leisure, presence of mind leads to superficiality. Superficiality leads to a disparagement of the Torah. A second explanation that is given is a bit more psychological, and again, we're talking about generalizations, and I will discuss the special factors that apply in this day and age. That is, if any of you have had experience learning Gemara, and this is a problem with men too, learn Gemara. Many men also, Gemara is not necessarily, they have the same problem. And that is, when you learn a typical page of Gemara, you have five opinions, and people often ask, well, what is the bottom line? What is the answer? What's going on? What's the result? And you can have a very big Talmud Chacham giving you a shir, and the Talmud Chacham say, well, I don't know what the result, that's not important. And you're sitting there, what do you mean it's not important? What you do is not important? Says, yeah, that's not why we're learning. We're learning to see that there are 10 opinions and 15 different views, and each opinion there are 5 different pshatim, etc. And it is said that the idea of a woman trying to create an environment in this world has a certain sensitivity and a penchant for how it plays out in real life. And since abstract Talmud study does not often focus on how things play out in real life, so such a learning, using this word, is tasteless, and again, we're talking about a generality that was made at the time, tasteless and without meaning, because it does not address the application of how abstractions play out. So that's more of a psychological meaning. And then there is yet a third meaning, which is spiritual psychological, and that is Chazal do say that women were given what is called Bina Yesera, extra understanding, that could be understood as intuition or the like, and it was said that there is often an initial flash of insight and understanding that cannot be explained cognitively or logically. And Gemara itself is predicated on a developmental, gradual sense of building things up. In fact, the truth of the Gemara, in fact, there's a difference between the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud in this regard, a very interesting point. The Jerusalem Talmud is not even studied that much today, unfortunately. We don't even have a good text of it. But if you look at the Babylonian Talmud, a huge work, you will discover the following idea. Most of the time, truth is established by the negation of multiple falsity. Meaning, you set up a wrong thing and you show why it's wrong. Then you set up another wrong thing and you show why that's wrong. And when you kill your 10 mistakes, you're finally left with the truth. In other words, the truth is arrived at by a process of elimination. The Jerusalem Talmud, which is much shorter, doesn't do that. The Jerusalem Talmud just says, this is the answer. And it is even said that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael was conducive to intuitively understanding the truth without the need to negate falsehood. Once again, it is said that advanced Talmudic study is predicated on this notion of arriving at the truth by negation of alternative possibilities, and that would be inconsistent with the method of thinking that is predicated on Bina Yisera. Yes. That's a Gemara in Maseches Nida. Yes, Vayiven Hashem Elokim Es Hatzela. God built up the side. So the word Bina is connected to Bina Yisera. I can give you the exact page. I never know. All right, but now that's the first explanation. But that, all of that is going with tasteless. In other words, it doesn't, again, and that doesn't mean it's forbidden yet. Again, it just says, as a generalization, many women, Chazal are talking in their time in particular, will find it without taste. And that doesn't even say they shouldn't do it, but it'll be without taste for them. Now, the second interpretation seems to be more condemnatory, immorality. It is conducive to immorality. Well, first of all, if you look at this statement in its exact context, it isn't really saying too much. Because Rabbi Eliezer's point might just be, you shouldn't tell your daughter about the idea that if she does mitzvos, the sota water is not going to hurt her. Simply because, in that context, if you give her that free pass, she'll be mezana. In other words, according to that, if you take this in a very literal, contextual way, he's not referring to anything other than that particular law, which doesn't even apply today, right? That's a narrow way of looking at it. But if you take it the other way, it is said, and again, this is, again, a generalization that some will have trouble with, and that is that when one is exposed, I mean, again, if you look at Gemara, many types of Gemara, you're exposed to a world of cheaters, right? A lot of the Gemara deals with what happens when people are lying, how do you get around it, how do you resolve it, etc. Just like law school, in effect. You know, when you go to, and I can speak about this, that when one goes to law school, one of the things one learns is how to deceive, how to connive, how to undermine, how to circumvent. And it was thought, Chazal thought, or Rabbi Eliezer thought, like this interpretation, that being introduced to the subtleties and the frauds which Halacha is trying to address could actually be a source of inculcating some of those negative factors into a personality. What about men? The answer is, men had it anyway. Again, there was a notion here. There was a notion here of a natural spirituality that could become tainted. Now, again, I'm very well aware. I'm very, very well aware of the fact that in American law, in the 19th century, and before the 19th century, much discrimination against women was often defended on the idea that the woman is the superior person who should not be tainted by entry into the job markets and should not be corrupted by the rat race and everything else. And this was often used to create a gilded cage. I understand that idea. And you know, people could raise these questions and the like, but certainly Chazal did have, and this could be a source for another discussion, although you will find statements going both ways, but by and large, Chazal do speak very, very highly about the natural emuna and faith and that women possessed, and there was a fear that the subtlety of analysis might undermine what is called emuna pshuta. But be it as it may, even when you, and I should also add too, that there is yet another aspect of a fear that is not always articulated. That if you release women into the study of Torah, what's going to happen to the kids and to the bayit and to the family? Chazal did not always articulate it that way, but it's fairly clear that there was a tremendous fear that, you know, who's going to take care of the kids if this happens? And that is a fear that to this very day, again, people don't always say it in that way, but that does underlie a great deal of opposition to issues. Men are frankly afraid in a lot of ways. I don't mean the old fear of, you know, the empowerment issues, which is a political issue, but I'm talking about the genuine dilemma of what's going to happen. Now, we will see that hopefully there are ways of reconciling and balancing and doing it all in this sense, but certainly classically there was a fear. So in effect, the tiflis idea has two translations, either tasteless without meaning or conducive to immorality, and depending on how you translate it, the condemnation of Rebbe Eliezer either rests on a woman not having the presence of mind, unable to concentrate on this, and therefore she would not appreciate Torah, or more attuned to the bottom line, and therefore doesn't want to go through all these different preliminary views, or it would undermine their sense of intuitive morality by giving them this process, etc. And finally, the fear that it would undermine Shalom Bayit and the raising of children. But again, just to keep the textual matter in mind, no matter how this plays out, this is only the view of Rabbi Eliezer. Ben Azai states the first view. Ben Azai says, Chaya, a father must teach a daughter. So even when you walk away from the Mishnah, you don't yet have an unequivocal condemnation of anything. Number one, it's a machlokes, an argument. And number two, Rabbi Eliezer himself did not use the word asur. So maybe he's only giving you his own parental advice. So the first major issue in which this now becomes translated into a prohibition in halacha are the words of the Rambam. So the Rambam is a very pivotal text here, because the Rambam, on the basis of one statement in the Mishnah, which is the statement of one person, all of a sudden gets elevated into Tzivu Chachamim, the Chachamim commanded. Who are the Chachamim, the sages who commanded? There's only one person, right? So the Rambam paraphrases the Mishnah, Tzivu Chachamim. And if you look in the Rambam, there are many, many interesting points that the Rambam makes, just in terms of textually. First of all, the Rambam paskins like Rabbi Eliezer, not like Ben Azai, which in itself is notable. Second of all, the Rambam construes Rabbi Eliezer as creating a prohibition. Not only you don't have to do it. Third of all, the Rambam does interpret tiflut not to mean immorality, but rather the first way, tasteless, meaningless. And once again, if you look at the language of the Rambam, you can interpret the Rambam two ways, probably more than two ways. One, you have that on page 153 of your material. Perhaps we should just reread the language of the Rambam and translate it. This is the Rambam, Maimonides, who lived in the 1000s and 1100, early 1100s. In the Laws of Torah Learning, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud Gimel, Chapter 1, Paragraph 13. Isha Shalomda Torah Yesh La Sechar. A woman who learns Torah gets reward. Which seems to say, you know, it's a meritorious act. Then he says, Aval Eino Kischaro Ish. The reward for that is not the same as a man, but Meshalon is Tavis. That's a general rule. In other words, any mitzvah you're not commanded to do, there's a less reward for it. But then he says, Aval Pishiyesh Lashchar, even though she gets reward, Tzivo Chachamim. The Chachamim commanded. This is Rabbi Eliezer. Shalom Yolamed Adam Esbito Torah. A man should not teach his daughter Torah. This is taken from the Mishnah in Sota. Why? Mipnei Sherof Hanashim. So note that the Rambam adds most women. Now, most, not all. And of course, what is most in one generation could change in another generation. In other words, the Rambam is already telling you that this is not a categorical rule, but it depends on your composition of a population. Ein datan mechuvenes lehislamed. Their minds is not directed lehislamed, to become educated. Let me just translate it literally first. Umotzios divrei Torah, and they will take words of Torah, ledivrei havoi, towards ends of foolishness. Havoyis, foolishness. Lefi anius daton. Again, I'm just translating here. According to the poverty, the impoverishment of their knowledge. Now, one could read this, and one could say, oh my God, you know, one could say, what is this saying? But on the other hand, the Rambam could very well be reflecting nothing more than the sociological reality of not having time, not having opportunity, not having an ability to concentrate because of these other duties. In other words, there is no reflection here at all on intelligence, on talent, on ability. Certainly, we all know the present reality is, I mean, I teach in a law school, and we now have around 51% women, and it is inevitable. Every year the valedictorian is usually a woman, since I've been teaching there. So, you know, the issue is not intellect at all. And one does not have to give a misogynistic interpretation in this Rambam. One could say the Rambam is simply going back to the first idea that I mentioned, that the inability to have the time and the concentration results in superficiality. And when there is superficiality, there will be foolish conclusions that are drawn. And therefore he says, Amru Chachamim, Kamo Lamed Espita Torah, Kilo Lim De Tiflis. Okay. But then the Rambam makes a new chiluk, and this is the first time this is made. Bamed Devorim Amurim. When does Rabbi Eliezer say there is an Iser of a father teaching a daughter Torah? That is only if it is the oral law. But the written law, he should not teach her this in the first instance, but if he does, it is not as if he is teaching her this foolishness. So the Rambam is mechalek between the oral law and the written law, which is fine, but then he kind of backtracks and says, but you know, even the written law better not. The problem is the Taz writes that the makor, why the oral law is not within Rabbi Eliezer's prohibition, is from the mitzvah of Hakel, the 613th mitzvah of the Torah. Every 7 years, the men, women, and children get together and they hear the Melech reading the Torah. And it was explained. So obviously, therefore, there's no Isser of Torah Shebichsav. But then the problem is, if there is no Isser of Torah Shebichsav, how can the Rambam say you shouldn't do that b'chadchila? So the Rav Shulchan Aruch, other poskim, totally delete the problem of Torah Shebichsav, although they don't offer the explanation for the Rambam, and we are left with this Isser of Torah Shebal Peh, meaning Rabbi Eliezer's view is limited to the oral law. Again, because the oral law has the dangers that we discussed. So, if you look, however, at the Achronim, there are some very important limitations in the Rambam's ruling. Because the Rambam seems to be self-contradictory. A woman who learns Torah gets reward, but the Chachamim say, don't teach your daughter Torah. What sense is that? So there's an extremely important source. I don't know if it was reproduced here. It was not reproduced here, but this is a source from a sefer called the Drisha. The Drisha is a commentary on the Torah, the code of Rav Yaakov ben Ashir, where the Drisha, in fact, I'm not sure if Drisha is named after Drisha, although it fits, because the Drisha is a good source for Drisha, for the Institute, and that is, the Drisha writes that the Chachamim never said, and Rabbi Eliezer never said, that a woman should not learn Torah. Rather, he talked about a father not teaching the daughter Torah. Meaning to say that Limud HaTorah should not be something that is forced on a woman, because it was felt that in many ways it may stunt her natural development as a wife and as a mother, at least the Torah Shebal Peh we're talking about, the Gemara and everything else. However, and this is why you're here tonight, if an adult woman, and of course an adult in Judaism is 12 years old, right? It doesn't have to be that old. If an adult woman has a desire and a cheshek, a yearning, to learn Torah, she should be encouraged to do so, because that is what will help her to become a Jew. So the Drisha makes a very important difference that kol hamalamed es bito Torah ki ilu malamda tiflis, because you might be giving her something that is counterproductive to her spiritual growth, but the adult who wants to come to Torah on her own should be encouraged and given that opportunity. So that's a very important point, and this is, of course, why, historically, we do have many, many instances of learned women, and in fact, in that very same Sefer, in the introduction to the commentary of the Drisha, which was written after the Mechaber died, but his sons wrote an introduction in which they talk about the great scholarship of their mother, Mrs. Drisha, Rabbi Yeshua Falk's wife, who was a very great authority in the laws of Nida and various other things. And they even quote, and they talk about the fact, and she even mentions that, I'm going to say they mention, that all of the yeshiva students who used to eat at our table knows very well how our mother would always participate in all of the Talmudic discussions. And then when they would ask questions, oh, do we have that there? Okay, okay. All right, so it's there, yeah. Yes, even Toshe Bofer. Yeah, even Toshe Bofer. And they even quote a halacha that their mother was Mechadesh, a halacha that many people follow today, that you know, when you light the Shabbos candles Friday nights, we first light the candle, then we make the blessing, because once we make the blessing, we've accepted Shabbos. So first we light the candle, cover our eyes, then make the blessing. And many people do that on Yom Tov as well. And she was Mechadeshes, that there's no reason to do that on Yom Tov because you're allowed to light. So therefore you should follow the normal rule of first making the blessing and then lighting the candle from an existing candle. And she was the one that originated that halacha, although the Magen Avraham argues with it too. He says that he doesn't agree with that halacha. So the concept is that this is why, that even though it is true that the formal educational opportunities for women in Torah Shabbat were historically very limited, to be sure, but certainly on the one-to-one basis for motivated people, the options were open. In fact, some say that the commentary instead. But again, there's a whole book. What is her book? All Your Children Shall Be Learned. An entire book on the history of women's Torah study, which is a very, very worthwhile book for you to look at, in which she gathers together all of the historical accounts. But again, the Drisha is extremely important, because I think the Drisha is the halachic basis for the endeavors that should be encouraged today for reasons that I will mention, and that is, whatever restrictions there are in requiring a Torah Shabbat Peh curriculum for young children, certainly an adult is defined as already as bas mitzvah, can be encouraged to pursue the interests of Torah that they have, and not only in the written Torah, but even in the Torah Shabbat Peh as well. And I should say that sometimes in the right-wing communities, there's a bit of historical revisionism that goes on. One very infamous example was the Torah Tamima, who actually wrote a very, very fascinating four-volume biography of his family. And part of that was translated. My uncle, the Nitziv, perhaps many of you have seen, his uncle was the world-famous Rosh Hashiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. And I remember I got this book in the mail from the Lakewood Cheder. And a few weeks later, they sent me a recall notice. Like, you wonder, you know, recall notice, like it was a dangerous book. And they said, because, you know, the famous story that the Russian government wanted to introduce secular studies in Volozhin, and then it sort of closed down the yeshiva. This is like a legend in the yeshiva world, that before you introduce secular studies, you just close down the yeshiva. Well, the Torah Tamima, who was the Nitziv's nephew, and was in Volozhin at the time, had a different version of the story, that the Nitziv was willing to have secular studies, etc. And when the Lakewood sent a note saying that, well, he didn't really know, he was young at the time, he didn't really know, and you'll get the wrong impression, therefore, please send back the book, we'll give you a full refund. I can assure you that anyone that got that letter would absolutely, you know, even if you didn't read the book, you would certainly look for the book then. But, in another example, this was there's a chapter in the book about women who study Torah. And he gives a lot of stories about the women who were great Torah scholars. For example, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe's mother, was a Bucky in all of Shas. I mean, she knew the entire Talmud very, very thoroughly. But in there, he describes the Nitziv's first wife. The Nitziv's second wife was actually the Torah Tamima's sister. And he describes how the Nitziv's first wife would sit all day. She was not of good health, but she would sit all day near the oven with a constant pile of Sfarim on the table, and she including Gemaras and everything else. And that's in the Hebrew. In the English, this is amazing, which is the one that they sent you, it says she sat all day with, it left out the words Gemara, it left out some of the more Torah Shavuot ideas. So people read the English, they don't know what it says in the Hebrew, but someone made a comparative study of all these little changes that are made in translation. So clearly, this drisha is a very, very important yesod, and this really brings me to the final aspect, which is the most important of all, and that is the fact that this is one of those halachos where although the principles are eternal, their application may vary with time, place, circumstance, and nature of society in the following way. And this goes back really, and you have this, the Chafetz Chaim is a very historically it's a very important document. The Beis Yaakov movement, which was the first widespread movement of compulsory education, as it were, for girls on a widespread level, was started in the 20th century after World War I by Sarah Schneer, and this was a deviation from established practice in which girls did not necessarily go to schools, at least beyond the very basic young age. Although I should mention, by the way, there's a tshuva, just to digress, there's a tshuva of the Rambam going back, in spite of the Rambam's words here, where apparently he had a shaila about a woman who was a widow, and she made a living as a chumash instructor for young boys. And her question was about compensation. It had nothing to do with whether she's allowed to do it, and the Rambam just answered her question as if this was a matter-of-fact situation. That was perfectly okay. So even in the Rambam, there's a deviation between what really happened and the halachic theory. But when the Beis Yaakov movement started, there were many Hasidic leaders, and Hasidim, or Hasidim followers even more so, who were opposed to what she was doing because they thought this would be a violation of the Rambam's halacha and Rabbi Eliezer's dictum that if you teach your daughter Torah, it's as if you're teaching her that which is either tasteless or immoral. And eventually she did get the endorsement of Gedolei Yisrael, and one of the most important documents was the validation that the Chafetz Chaim gave to the idea of Beis Yaakov. The Chafetz Chaim was the Gadol Hador, and his imprimatur was extremely important. And he basically said, he focused on the sociological changes in Jewish society. That in the days when Jews lived insulated lives, in the days where Jews were less exposed to the currents of secular culture, it could very well be true that what women needed to be good Jews were simply the transmission of information from mother to daughter within the family unit. But once there is familial breakdown, once there is greater exposure to the outside world, the need for intellectual structured study becomes more imperative simply because all of these other options are becoming apparent. And it was very, very true that before Beis Yaakov, it was a, I don't know how common it was, but it did happen, where even in Hasidic homes, the men and the boys would come home for Friday nights, and the women would go to the theater that night. They would pursue various other events. Sometimes they bought the ticket before Shabbos and they would go, and sometimes they just didn't keep Shabbos. And this was such a dangerous and turbulent time that there was an imperative to create this type of school. Now, the Chafetz Chaim did not emphasize the fact that women were better educated simply because they actually weren't yet. He just emphasized, you're exposed to the decadence of society, you need to combat it with Torah. But today, there's an additional set of considerations. And that is, clearly, it does not make sense that Chazal envisioned a circumstance where women can be lawyers and doctors and accountants and have doctorates in comparative anthropology, but they are supposed to be ignorant of Torah. One might say that Chazal were generally suspicious of formalized educational programs for women because they thought it would undermine taking care of the children. They thought it would undermine the needs of maintaining a home. They thought it would take away the spontaneous feelings of emunah that were said to be intuitive to women, and you're destroying the intuition by exposing them to the different types of elements in formalized systems. But all of that works only if you've created a world where women generally did not have access to those systems. Where you have a world where every type of intellectual inquiry and every type of profession is open, then the dynamic is exactly the opposite. As one of the great rabbis said, if it used to be you teach your daughter Torah, ki'ilu malam de tiflis, here, if you don't teach your daughter Torah, you are teaching her tiflis. In other words, it is said that, I think the Chafetz Chaim himself remarked, that it's much better to do something that is as if it's tiflis, and not really tiflis, because what is the alternative? And consequently, we find among many, many rabbanim, it's not universal. And again, you can understand that maybe within a Satmar society, which is more insular, perhaps the old method is going to work to keep people as faithful Jews, although I'm not sure. But in a society where every other avenue is open, what is the sense? Is it the pshat that law and medicine are more worthy of a Jewish woman's time than the studying of the Torah of Hashem? That's not a sensible proposition, and therefore Chazal can be understood only against the backdrop of a society where, to be frank, it was thought to be more desirable that women not get involved in intellectual pursuits, because it might undermine the bias. Well, we could debate whether that is desirable or not desirable, but that's not the reality. And given the fact that that is not the reality, in such a circumstance, the Chachamim never intended to create any type of prohibition. Now again, how far do you go with that? Would that even legitimate, you know, the detailed, complicated, abstract, you know, discussions in the Gemara? Or does it simply mean an expanded curriculum of what is relevant in modern life? There'll be different versions on that. I know Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, for example, who is generally very broad-minded, did suggest that at least, let's say, things like the laws of sacrifices and the like, that would be something he would not encourage women to pursue necessarily. But on the other hand, he said most of the sugyos, most of the Talmudic discussions of moed, of the holidays, of marriage and divorce, and even of civil law, like torts and inheritance, that he said he felt would be an appropriate subject. Others say the emphasis should be more on the Orech Chaim, on the laws of Shabbos, the laws of Kashrus, and the like. But be it as it may, it makes no sense to say you can have a PhD in something, but learning will only be at a grade school level. You have to give an intellectual experience that is commensurate with the intellectual abilities and training and competencies. So this is a difficult case study in a sense, because we normally take the position that halacha is immutable and unchangeable. And if we wouldn't have someone like the Chafetz Chaim that kind of opens up the key for us, we would have to kind of say the same thing here. And you know, I would not say this on my own, but given the fact, as the Chafetz Chaim is telling us, that certain expressions of Chazal have to be understood, and I want to say certain because it is dangerous. One should not generalize and say, oh, so we could change the whole kit and caboodle. You know, you can't start a fire on Shabbos because you have to rub two stones together and now it's so easy. Obviously, that's a dangerous rhetoric. But within the guidance that Gedolim give us, we have to have a sensitivity that there are certain statements of Chazal that are very time and place sensitive and must be understood against the backdrop of what will ensure a better Jewish people, what will create spiritual growth, what will result in a greater commitment to Yiddishkeit. And under those circumstances, when you have a suboptimal, frankly, Chazal might view the whole role of women in the world as suboptimal. That's a whole other issue. But given that reality, the only way you improve the situation is by increasing the access to Torah learning. And I'm not at all saying this because of what I often hear, which is a bit offensive. I mean, you often hear this rhetoric from so-called Jewish Orthodox feminists that we want to get the power too, like as if it's some type of political game. We want to get the power. Psak halach is power. We want to get the power. I don't want to address that. That is not a religious emotion, whether it's expressed by men or women, because Yiddishkeit is not, and it should not be, about power and control. That is not the issue. The issue is simply this, that for a woman who has been educated and who has grown in many, many areas, not to have a commensurate growth in Yiddishkeit will mean that her Jewish attachment is not going to be that strong, because it seems to be immature, it seems to be superficial, it seems not to have meaning. And therefore, we have to increase that meaning and commitment, which will require something commensurate to her ability to enter training. Not as a matter of power, and not as a matter of control. Again, those are frankly repulsive sentiments, but as a matter of each and every one of us becoming the servant of Hashem that we are supposed to be. Yiddishkeit is about being a servant. It is not about being a master. But even to be a servant, you have to understand what it is to be a servant. And that requires an exposure to Torah. So here's where we have a point in which our Gedolim have indicated that there is a need for expanded opportunities for learning. And that's why I think it's a wonderful thing that you're able to get together. And Amir Hashem, it should continue with much, much hatzlacha. And I apologize if anything I said was at all offensive. But I do wish you truly much, much success in all of your endeavors. If you would just give me another 2 minutes, people can get it to Hillam from the wall. If you just say... I can do that. Yeah. I just want to recite that Tehillim 130. I'll if you have the article, it's also in the article sitter.
You can say it after, whatever.
Oh, just repeat it after? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well. Okay.
We'll repeat after Rabbi Brenner.
Okay, we'll just say one. Mimamakim.
Mimamakim.
Yeah, this is the Art Scroll Siddur. It is page 540, and it's Tehillim 130. Kuf Lamed. Kuf Lamed. 130 is the Tehillim. It's page 540 in the Art Scroll Siddur.
Visi Adonai Kipson Apshi with Baro Hokoti. Napshi Ladonai Mishomim Laboker, Shomim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai, Kim Adonai Hachesed, Bahade, Mo Fidus. Vahu Yiftah es Yisrael Mikol Avonosav.
Misha Berech Avoseinu Avram Yitzchak Yaakov Moshe Aaron David Shlomo Yivarech Rapes Achola Bracha Devore Mindel Basbasia Favor Shekol Akol Mispalalim Bavura Yizchar Zeh Kadosh Baruch Yimalei Rachamim Olah Lachlimo Leraposa Lachaziko Lachayosa Yishlach Lamehera Refuah Shlema Min Hashemayim Lechol Evarea Lechol Gidara B'soch shar chol Yisrael, refuas hanefesh, refuas haguf, hashda ba'galah, v'zman kariv, v'nomar amen.